The Torah content from now through Pesach has been sponsored by the Kofsky family in loving memory of Adira, who loved big ideas and asking big questions. Hello, I'm Rabbi Matt Schneeweis, and this is the Stoic Jew Podcast, where we explore the relationship between Judaism and Stoicism. In today's episode, I'd like to explore a few ideas that I had about the machlokes, the disagreement between Stoicism on the one hand and Judaism as exemplified in the holiday of Purim on the other. So we're going to focus on Epictetus, and we're going to read three excerpts from his works. And I'm going to read all three of them, and then we'll go back and discuss them in context. Okay, so the first excerpt is from the Discourses, Book 4, Chapter 4, Section 39. Epictetus writes, "There is only one road to happiness. Let this rule be at hand morning, noon, and night. Stay detached from things that are not up to you." Okay, the second excerpt is from Epictetus' Enchiridion, the Handbook, Chapter 14. He writes, "Whoever then wishes to be free, let him neither wish for anything nor flee from anything that depends on others. Otherwise, he must be a slave." And the third excerpt is from the Discourses, Book 2, Chapter 16, Section 1. "Where is the good? In our choices. Where is the evil? In our choices. Where is neither of them? In those things we do not choose." So we've talked about this a lot, that the core of Epictetus' Stoicism is to make the distinction between things that are in your control and things that are not in your control, and to only focus on the things that are in your control. And if you try to control what's not in your control, then you are setting yourself up for disappointment and misery. And this is a very rational philosophy, and we've seen time and time again how the Torah promotes this way of looking at things as well, especially in the book of Mishle, which is about how to make decisions based on what is in your control and preparing yourself realistically and assessing what the consequences might be in terms of the things that are outside of your control. So we're not going to challenge any of that. However, I believe that the story of Purim shows that Judaism has a unique orientation towards factors that are not in your control, and that Judaism does not advocate for the stance of ignoring what is not in your control. And I'd like to share two excerpts from this, from the teachings of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, the Rav. And this is found in this book that I got called Megillat Esther Mesorat HaRav, published by Koren and OU Press. So the first excerpt is on page 56, which is his commentary. And again, I don't know exactly where these comments are drawn from. They cite their sources in some cases and not in others. So I don't know if this is something the Rav wrote, or if something that is something that he said, or if it's something that was paraphrased or summarized from his notes. But anyway, this is on the opening scene of the Megillah. So the opening scene is very, very lavish, describes the whole party atmosphere that Ahasuerus set up. And the commentary from the Rav says as follows. He says, "The Jew is involved in events which at the outset seem to have no relevance to him. When the curtain rises on Act One of the drama, we see on the stage a half-drunk mob feasting, indulging, and passing judgment on the beauty of the women. As events progress, we see a proud queen refusing to obey the order issued by her lord and master and the punishment which was meted out to her. Prima facie, these events are of no relevance to the hundreds of thousands of Jews who lived in the Persian Empire. However, as we continue reading, we discover the significance of these events and their relatedness to our people. The conclusion is obvious. There are no neutral events in human history which the Jew may dismiss as irrelevant. The Jew is totally involved in all events and in all major struggles. Even now, the future welfare of the Jew is dependent upon the outcome of the titanic struggle between East and West. Even the final redemption of our people will be precipitated by the apocalyptic battle between Gog and Magog. Providence involves the Jew in great events. Willy-nilly, the Jew plays his part on the universal historical stage." Okay, so I thought that was a really eloquent interpretation for why the opening of the Purim story includes so many seemingly irrelevant details, because if you just read the first story, the opening scene, you would be like, what does this have to do with Jews and Judaism? But only when you see it in the context of how the events unfold do you realize that Vashti's death at the hands of Ahasuerus was the cause of Esther rising to prominence, and the, you know, which ultimately is going to be what saved the Jews from Haman's decree. Right? So we have this bird's eye perspective because we see how the story ends. But if we were in the events themselves, it'd be very easy if you're a Jew to say, oh, what does Ahasuerus' party have to do with us? In the same way that many Jews, myself included, look around at various world events and say, this has nothing to do with us. You know, this is not our people. There might not even be Jews there. Why should we care about this? In reality, because the Jews and the Torah and the mission of the Avos, of the forefathers, is part of the destiny of mankind and part of God's providence on the entire universe, or sorry, on the entire, at least on the entire earth, then anything that happens on earth can potentially be interconnected with us, even though we don't see that interconnection. So I actually want to transition from there to another excerpt from the Rav's commentary. This is much later in the story, This is when Haman casts the lottery. And this actually gets to the essence of Purim itself. The name Purim means lot, and the holiday is named after the lottery that Haman cast in order to determine which day to kill the Jews. So this is what the Rav says. He writes, "The decree of Ahasuerus was unreasonable, absurd, an accident. Is not Purim the memorial to, and the book of Esther the story of, human vulnerability? The ancient Greeks looked upon fate as something absurd, unalterable, and ruthless, that at best is indifferent to the aspirations of man. We Jews have certainly rejected their mythological fate or fates. There is nothing accidental in nature. Fate and fortune belong to the creation order, which God sanctioned, and as such, there is reasonableness to every event. However, man was admitted to understand certain creation orders, such as the mathematical physical one, while he was barred from coming close to the goral, or fate order. That is why it appears to him irregular, absurd, and hostile. However, Judaism, though it knew of and tried to understand catastrophic events that viciously destroy man, his hopes and dreams, could not accept the existence of unreasonable accidents in human life. Judaism maintains that events, which we call unreasonable and which we classify under the rubric of accident or fate, belong to a higher divine logos order into which man has not been initiated. Even the most unreasonable events may begin to reveal their structural patterns in retrospection. Retrospection sheds light upon many enigmatic, allegedly unreasonable events. When man views those absurd freak accidents in the context of the experiences that followed them, the freakish event may appear to be a regular one. In hindsight, many events become understandable, endowed with rationality." So this is really the core idea that I want to propose here, which is that on the one hand, Judaism agrees with the Stoics that you should not try to control what is outside of your control. And if you do, then you're setting yourself up for disaster. And in fact, that's what Avodah Zarah is, what idolatry is when you believe, you have this wish or a wish or a fear that prompts you to feel like you ought to be able to control reality. And instead of engaging in reality via rational decision-making, then you project something that doesn't actually exist, a false god or a superstitious force, and you believe that by appeasing that force that you can somehow affect your destiny. So that's the Avodah Zarah is the ultimate expression of how Judaism's opposition to Avodah Zarah is the ultimate expression of where Judaism is in line with Stoicism, namely that you should only focus on controlling what is within your control rationally. However, Judaism also cultivates or seeks to cultivate an orientation towards those factors which are not in your control. So let's take the Purim story, right? Esther and Mordecai, mostly Esther. Esther took all of the used all of her wisdom and strategized based on all the factors within her control in a way that maximized her chances of success. And my favorite illustration of this is in the Gemara in Megillah, where it goes through all of the reasons why Esther invited Haman to a second party, right? The events are that she fasted for 3 days and had all the Jews fast, and then she went to Ahasuerus, risked her life in order to appear before him and to hoping that he was going to give her an audience, and it worked, and she, he said, what can I give you? So she said, I would like you and Haman to come to this party that I'm going to make. So the king says, okay, fine. So they get to the party, and there the king is expecting Esther to say what she wanted, what the request is. And so instead of asking to save the Jews, she said, come to a party tomorrow and I'll tell you what I'm requesting. So the Gemara goes through the question, why did she invite Haman to the second party? So if you go through the Gemara there, then you'll find all of these very, very strategic reasons why she did this. She wanted to plant suspicion in the minds of Ahasuerus. She wanted to incite the jealousy of the other ministers and hope that they would somehow stage a coup to remove Haman from power. She wanted to to stoke Haman's ego, to make him think that he's beloved to the king and the queen, and therefore that would cause him to lower his guard. She wanted to make Ahasuerus suspicious that she might be having an affair with Haman. So she had all of these things in mind. Yet, what did they do at the same time? Is she had the Jews throughout the entire kingdom fast and engage in tefillah, in prayer, and in tshuva, and in repentance. And this is really, in other words, she engaged in the institution of Hilchos Tanyos, of the laws of fast. And I'm sure I've read this in previous episodes, but this is a perfect example of what Judaism's orientation is towards chants. So I'm going to read from the opening halachos, the laws of the Rambam in the laws of fast. And he says, So it is a positive commandment from the Torah to cry out in prayer to God and to sound the trumpets for every event of distress that befalls the community. Shnemar, as it says, Ahatzar Hatzor Eschem Vaharios Machatzotros. On the tormentor who torments you, you shall sound the trumpets. Klomar, meaning to say, Kol davar sheyatzer lechem, anything that afflicts you. Kagon batsores v'dever v'arba v'kiyos behen. For example, like drought and plague and locusts and other things like that. Zaku lehem v'hariyu. Cry out upon them and sound the trumpets. Now, in these examples, this is really anything that befalls the community that is a threat. So whether it is something that we have more control over of, like let's say an enemy invades us and we can fight back, or whether it's something we have absolutely no control over of, like a drought where it just stops raining and there's no water. So no matter what, we engage in this process of sounding the trumpets and crying out to God. So why do we do this? He says, "V'davar ze midarch derech midarchei hateshuvahu." This is one of the methods of doing teshuva, of repenting. Shebizman shetavotzara, that at a time when this threatening event arrives, v'yizaku laviyariu, and we cry out to God and sound the trumpets. Yedu hakol, everyone will know. Shebiglal ma'aseim harayim hura lahem, that because of our evil actions, this happened to us. Or because of their evil actions, this happened to them. Kakasuv, as it is written, Avonoseichem hitu ele lachem, that your iniquities incline this towards you. Vzehu shiyigrim lahem lahasir hatzara meleim. This will cause them to remove the distressing event from upon themselves. So in other words, the thing happens, okay, and it is not in our control, but what is in our control is our reaction to it. That if we can utilize this as an impetus to improve ourselves, then God will remove the trouble from us. Now, I realize that this strays into territory about divine intervention, hashgacha. We've talked about that as well, and I don't know what the Stoics hold about that. But the point is that we cannot directly control the drought or the locust, but we can use this event to change the way that we look at things and to change our own actions and improve ourselves going forward. But this is the part that I wanted to get to. He says, "Aval im lo yizaku v'lo yariu." But if we do not cry out and do not sound the trumpets, ela yomru, but rather they say, "Davar zemi min hag ha'olam erlano v'tzar zo nikra nikris." But they say, "Oh, this is just the way of the world, or this is just a chance occurrence." Harizo derech achzarius. This is an approach of cruelty or indifference. V'goremus lehem lihidabek b'maaseim harayim, and this will cause them to cling to their evil actions. V'tosif hatzara v'tzaras acheras, and that Sarah, that distressing event and others will increase. Hushakazu b'Torah, this is what is written in the Torah, in God's language. V'halachtem imi b'keri, if you walk with me, with God, with chance. V'halachti imachem b'chamas keri, I will walk with you with the fury of chance. Klomar, meaning to say, k'she'avi aleichem tzara k'desha tashuvu, when I bring upon you a distressing event in order to make you repent. Im tom rishu keri, if you say that this is a chance event, osif aleichem chamas oso keri, then I will increase upon you the wrath of that quote-unquote chance. So in other words, what's the difference between how a Stoic would relate to these events and how a Jew would relate to these events, right? Let's say you're a Jew in Shushan or a Jew in the Ahasuerus' kingdom, and you're a Stoic, okay? And suddenly Haman makes a decree and says he's going to kill everybody, right? So the Stoic might feel that, well, there's nothing I can do. I mean, maybe if he was in the court, like, you know, Seneca was, then, or Marcus Aurelius, when he's the emperor, then he would do something. But let's say you have no power. So you would tell yourself, okay, there's nothing I can do. And so I will not I will break my attachment to that which is not in my control. Okay, that was the first excerpt from Epictetus that we read. He says that there is only one road to happiness. Let this rule be at hand, morning, noon, and night. Stay detached from things that are not up to you. So he would say, okay, this is not up to me. Therefore, I don't care about it. I'm not going to make any decisions about it. Furthermore, he would say that if you do attach yourself to this, then you're a slave. Right? Whoever, he says, whoever then wishes to be free, let him neither wish for anything nor flee from anything that depends on others. Otherwise, he must be a slave. So he'd say, I don't want to be a slave to these events that are not in my control. And even more so, he would say that this is not even bad, right? Because that was the third excerpt. He says, where's the good in our choices? Where's the evil in our choices? Where's neither of them in those things we do not choose? So he might say that maybe you should, you know, maybe he would advocate for this teshuva approach, but he would say that how could I call the decree of Haman bad if it's not in my control? And I think this is really where Judaism tries to, Judaism one-ups the Stoics, because Judaism recognizes that even with regards to things that are not in our control, if we relate to them in a manner that develops ourselves, that's the whole institution of Hilchos Tanyos, of the fasting and doing tshuva and crying out to God. And if we recognize that there is an order in the universe, especially with regards to the nation, and that things that happen in the world are not happening by chance, that there is justice, everything happens in accordance with justice and a system there, and that by studying that and gaining knowledge of it to the extent that we can, and then internalizing those insights and lessons into our own behavior, then we are engaging within that system, even if we don't understand how things are going to play out. So then that is going to be a cause of our true happiness. And are we slaves? Are we servants? Yes, we are. We are servants to God. You know, we accept upon ourselves the Ol Malchus Shamayim, the yoke of heavenly kingship. We don't entertain the notion that we are going around free. In fact, when the Rambam is talking about the death of the enemies of God, you know, when he talks about, let's say, like the death of people who have abandoned and thrown off the yoke of Torah, and you know, don't keep the mitzvos and don't care about these things. He describes them as this is in Hillel's Avel, chapter 1, halacha 10. He says that they are they are free unto themselves like the other nations. You know, we are not a free nation; we are servants to God. So there is going to be a subordination to the will of God, not a desire to cast it off and be free. So if we recognize this, then this is what will make us able to make use of anything that happens, even things that are outside of our control, in order to strengthen our attachment to reality and to the true good. And actually bring about our salvation. I mean, that is the moral, you know, the punchline of the story is that Esther and Mordechai did this. They engaged the world of rational decision making through their strategizing, and they engaged the world of appealing to God through teshuva and tefillah. And as a result, then the evil decree was completely reversed, and we ended up succeeding and being saved. So, anyway, there's probably more to think about here, but those are just some thoughts I wanted to share about the how Judaism would fundamentally disagree with Epictetus on these points, and how the Purim story illustrates that. If you are interested in the episode I did on Purim last year, which focused on the drinking, I don't remember what I said because it was a year ago, and that was still in the blurry times of COVID. Then I added a link to that below, and. Yeah, that's it for today's episode. If you've gained from what you've learned here today, please consider contributing to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/RabbiSchneeweis. Alternatively, if you would like to make a direct contribution to the Rabbi Schneeweis Torah Content Fund, my Venmo is at Matt-Schneeweis, and my Zelle and PayPal are MattSchneeweis@gmail.com. Even a small contribution goes a long way to covering the cost of my podcast and will provide me with the financial freedom to produce even more Torah content for you. If you would like to sponsor a day's or a week's worth of content, or if you are interested in enlisting my services as a teacher or tutor, you can reach me at RabbiSchneeweis@gmail.com. Thank you to my listeners for listening. Thank you to my readers for reading. And thank you to my supporters for supporting my efforts to make Torah ideas available and accessible to everyone. And have a happy Purim.